Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on what you'll need to know about a busy week in politics. The president's new travel ban faces legal challenges from some states, including Minnesota. New allegations about the influence of outside governments is emerging as Congress prepares for a House intelligence hearing next Monday. We'll be broadcasting that live. And while the president's overall approval ratings are anemic, he's at 55% for his handling of the economy in a CNN poll. And we'll continue our discussion about the prospects of the GOP health care bill. And I want to hear from you on that. If you're a voter who voted on health care, that was a priority for you when you made your choice in November. How are you feeling about what the GOP wants to repeal and replace it with? And I'd like to hear your chief concerns about this. So if you're someone who, as you made your decision about who to support in November, Obamacare, healthcare was a main concern for you. Talk to me about that today as you listen to what the GOP is talking about replacing it with. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach me on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Kalila Brown-Dean, is Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and she is with us today from Pennsylvania. Kalila, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you.
Kimberly Atkins is with us. She's the Boston Herald's Washington correspondent, and she's in Washington, D.C. And Kimberly, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Kalila, I want to talk for just a minute about these jobs numbers, because as I noted, that CNN poll is showing that President Trump is getting some pretty good numbers for handling of the economy. President Trump said on the jobs numbers in November why you can't trust them. And this was just a week or so before he was elected. Let's listen.
The terrible jobs report that just came out shows the number of people not in the workforce increased by another 425,000 people last month. That's why you see these phony numbers about 5% unemployed. People are stopping. They're not looking for work anymore because they can't get a job. Then they take them off the rolls. These numbers are an absolute disaster.
So, Kalila, is this, I guess I'm trying to understand the way voters might see this. Does it undermine their faith in the kind of reporting that comes out of Washington? Or do people say more hyperbole from the campaign? Now we'll choose to believe what he says now that he's president. How do you see this?
Well, I think much of it depends on which voters we're talking about, who's receiving these messages. I think overall people who strongly support Trump, put their faith in him, will hear this and say, well, yes, this is different because he's the one that's driving these numbers as opposed to Barack Obama and all the questions that they had about whether that was valid. But to people who have been skeptical overall about when you support the numbers because they work in your favor, whether we're talking about vote returns or election margins or job numbers, do we think about the messenger or do we just focus on the raw data?
Kimberly, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that we're going to see a continuation of this problem with messaging with President Trump. He spoke so forcefully against the previous administration and really denounced other information that went behind it, including the jobs numbers, and convinced, you know, tried to convince folks that there are many, many more people that are unemployed that aren't showing up in these numbers, and giving numbers that would include things like people who are in college or people who had retired or stay-at-home parents to sort of inflate this number. And now all of a sudden they're saying, no, these numbers are absolutely true. It was a very good jobs report. It exceeded expectations in terms of the number of jobs added to the force in February. But it's taking a side seat, at least, if not a back seat, to this dichotomy of the president, of the side by side that you put up, of him denouncing these very numbers and then coming out now to take credit for them.
Yeah. And Kalila, the reason that I ask about this is there's a lot of information that comes out of the government that I think in the past we, like I was talking with Ken Rudin about the Congressional Budget Office numbers or what the intelligence community says. I mean, this undermining of you can't believe this and you can't believe that and you can only believe what I say about it, I think has a more concerning effect than it is when you take it piecemeal. And I'd like your thoughts on that.
I think if we look overall, it's very damaging because it erodes the public trust in a way that we never get to a point where we can move forward, not based on political party, not based on ideology, not based on the one who's giving their opinion. There are certain functions and dimensions of government that should be separate from the political process and from partisan motivations. So when we start questioning these kinds of numbers, whether we're questioning military involvement and what the motivation may be behind that, and the public only focuses on who's interpreting the data, then right. We miss out on these fundamental functions and what we actually need to do beyond a candidate.
Yeah, I mean, and Kimberly, this is why I brought up the CBO numbers on the health care bill. I mean, you know, what we may have here is the CBO coming out and saying, here's the numbers, here's what we assess this is going to mean to Americans and what it's going to cost, et cetera. And then we have a president and a majority in Congress who will say, pay no attention to those numbers. You can't believe them. They're not real. Is this unusual today, or have you often gotten that from the party in power who'd like to shape, you know, the message to their best advantage?
I think it's a matter of degree. I mean, in this case, as you pointed out, with the CBO numbers coming out on the healthcare plan sometime this week, we've already seen the White House spokesperson really denounce the CBO, saying if you want to get accurate numbers, that's not where you look. You know, it's the Congressional Budget Office. That's the government agency that's in charge of doing this. So saying that is pretty incredible. Look, President Obama, when they were crafting the Obamacare, we reporters call it, plan, himself would get frustrated with the CBO numbers saying that didn't paint a full picture. So this isn't brand new, but the way that it's being done, sort of this preemptive strike against this agency whose job it is to really look at the numbers, engage the impact, is really new. And if the previous report, the preliminary report about the effect of repealing the federal health care law holds true, and the CBO sticks with that, the CBO, of course, predicted that roughly 20 million people would lose their coverage. If they come out this week saying, yes, lots of people will lose coverage, and this is going to cost a lot more money than folks think, it's going to be a problem for messaging, not just for the president, but also for Republican leaders in Congress.
Yeah. And Kalila, before we go to the phones, and I want to take some calls on this, do you think that it is part of the reason, and I talked to Ken about this, that Speaker Ryan is positioning this as this is going to be the only bill and you'd better get behind it, or you're going to have to go back there and explain why we did nothing on the health care issue? Is he doing that because he really does feel like the legislative agenda of the White House and of the Republican majority is on the line with this bill?
I think that it's more than just legislative agenda and priority. I think Ryan is keenly aware that looking forward to those 2018 midterm elections, Republicans now have control of Congress and the presidency. If they cannot do something major and decisive to move whatever their agenda forward, it's not just about the policy, it's about the implications and what seats they can lose in Congress, what state legislative seats they'll lose, and what gubernatorial seats they'll lose. This is the moment for them to decide the future of their standing as individual legislators, but also the future of the party beyond just the presidency.
Kalila Brown-Dean is with us from Quinnipiac, and Kim Atkins is with us from the Boston Herald. And we're having a discussion this morning about the week in politics, but really zeroing in here on health care, because there's been a lot of discussion and debate, and Republicans have it on a fast track on Capitol Hill. I want to know if you're one of those voters who was unhappy with Obamacare, and now, as you see some of the details around this, what you think of what the GOP wants to replace it with. And let me go to the phones here to Michael, listening in St. Michael. Hey, Michael. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. What are you thinking about this? Did you like Obamacare? Was it something that you voted on?
Well, I certainly had that in mind. And I thought Obamacare was insufficient, especially as far as the way that pricing is done. I mean, this is where government has the opportunity to step up for the citizens and you know, take on those battles that against, you know, these corporate interests that are much too large for us to fight individually. But it seems as though it was a start, but I was only unhappy with it due to the fact that it was insufficient.
Okay. So you were hoping that Congress would build on it. Kimberly, despite what they say, is that something that they are basically doing?
It's hard to tell right now. It doesn't seem that way. It seems that what they're trying to do is this idea of keeping the popular aspects of the law, coverage for pre-existing conditions, allowing children to stay on their parents' health care plan until age 26. It seems that they want to keep these things, yet take away other parts that are not popular, like the individual mandate that requires you to purchase health care. Republicans keep saying they're giving access to health care, not a mandate. But those things don't necessarily go together when it comes to how to pay for it. Of course, the idea that people needed to buy health care keeps the health care law affordable. And the fact that not enough people joined it early enough with the federal health care law we have now caused a lot of trouble with quickly rising premiums. We saw that happen. So they're proposing something. You know, I think we've talked before about how Americans generally, they dislike Obamacare, but they like the Federal Health Care Act. They like the things that it does, and they want coverage, but they don't like this nasty messaging about all the bad stuff. And there are a lot of problems with the law. Believe me, I'm enrolled on the federal exchange myself, and I've seen my premiums go up, and I've seen coverage go down, and it is a problem. But the way they're going about it seems really unclear from the experts that I've talked to whether the new proposal is going to address these issues or whether it will create new issues.
Kalilo, what I find interesting here is when you, and I think Kaiser has done some of this analysis, when you cross people who are opposed to Obamacare with states and communities that are signed up and are getting some of those Medicaid benefits, by the way, the expansion, you see a lot of voters in red states and in districts that supported President Trump. I mean, what becomes clear here is that maybe these voters, and no blame on them that they don't understand this, because it's very confusing what the GOP wants to replace it with. But the GOP has got to be worried about, I don't know, 9 months down the line when people start to realize what this really means day to day for them.
This is another area where partisanship really should not be playing a role here. Because with all of the conversation of what's happening at the national level and, you know, the relationship between the president and the Congress, this will really be felt at the state level. When we talk about moving some of these subsidies toward block grant funds or removing the funding for Medicaid and having states have to pick that up, not everyone is in a state like Minnesota that has a budget surplus. Most are running at a very high deficit. So the question becomes, regardless of which way your state is leaning, how are you going to pay for this? And what are you going to do about the collateral consequences of moving people off of these roles and then having them go toward emergency rooms again for primary care treatment, or not having, you know, we're talking in the Northeast about the opioid crisis and about how many people can now get access to treatment because of the Affordable Care Act. If that goes away, this is more than just health and insurance. It's also public safety.
You know, Kimberly, I saw an administration official on one of the Sunday talk shows who said Medicaid was never supposed to be a long-term program. It was supposed to be a safety net. And when people get these tax credits and they get some of the other things that the bill does, they will themselves move off of Medicaid. Well, is there any evidence that that happens? Because hearing what Kalilo is saying, then it's going to be up to the states to decide who cannot stay on these Medicaid rolls when the money starts to go away.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think Medicaid, look, Social Security was supposed to be a safety net as well, too. And I don't think that if you polled Americans consistently, they don't want to see that go away. And they don't want to see Medicaid go away either. And a lot of these states who even those who have Republican governors who have complained about the Federal Health Care Act and who want change are the very states that accepted these sort of Medicaid expansions under the federal health care law. And I think rolling that back is both not only presents a potential problem. Again, we don't know exactly how the effects will be in terms of coverage and actually giving people access to health care, but also in terms of a political fallout if people see this go away. I think this is one of those areas where not everybody understands. Even people who are upset with the federal health care law didn't understand how it connects with Medicaid and how all of these things go together. And once lawmakers start tinkering with that and we see the effect, I think it could change both the political opinion of this and we might see people speaking out more, as we've already seen in some of these town halls, really voicing concerns that that they and their family members can get the sort of care that they need.
Bethany says on Twitter, prenatal services being covered is a must. As a healthy young woman that had three pregnancies with complications and was in the OB's office twice a week, we would be bankrupt if prenatal, which is preventative care, weren't covered. And then another listener on Twitter here says the Republican quote unquote solution to Obamacare is morally indefensible. Millions losing their coverage. Shame. We actually don't know how many people's healthcare coverage is going to be affected because we don't have those numbers and the details are pretty shaky here. To the phones to Joe in Bloomington. Hey, Joe, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on here.
What are you thinking?
I didn't. You asked if healthcare was an issue in the voting. I did not vote for Trump, and I also didn't vote for the other party. And one of the main reasons that I didn't for either one was because I didn't feel Obamacare was very good at all. I saw my premiums go up threefold, which is just huge. The cost of it and the burden on the family was quite big. In turn, my fear is that the other party now is going to come up with something that is either worse or just as bad. And I think this is where a lot of the dissatisfaction comes from the American people and why Trump actually got in. The politicians are not beholden to the people anymore. And I think that's the biggest problem. They're not listening and trying to do the right things. And I think it's a big issue, and I'm really glad that you have it on the program here.
Yeah, Joe, thanks very much for the call. Kalila, I give the voters a bit of a break, though. I hear Joe on this, but trying to understand a very complicated issue here and how quickly this is moving on Capitol Hill. I don't know who can possibly keep up with this. What would you say?
I think it is intentionally complicated, and this is probably one of the least transparent areas, and it's intentionally so. You had members of Congress who voted against the initial Affordable Care Act in 2010 who admitted that they had not read through the entirety of the bill. They hadn't even read the highlights. And they voted based on what their party told them to do. And so what we're seeing now is that perfection becomes the enemy of the good. Was Obamacare perfect? Certainly not. Did it have problems? Did it not go far enough? Did it go too far? Certainly. But the question now is, with what is being proposed on the table, it will have a devastating effect. And when you have members of Congress who have the obligation to communicate this info to their constituents and make comments about people choosing to buy a new iPhone as opposed to paying for health insurance, that's detrimental to the conversation, but it also contributes to the confusion. So I don't blame the American people for not knowing the finer points of this, because certainly their insurance carriers often did not make that clear as well.
Terry says on Twitter, I'm on COBRA, paying $1,076 a month for me and my two girls. I haven't heard anything about how the new plan would help me at all. I wanted to switch to the ACA this year, but with all of the uncertainty, I stayed on COBRA, which, as we know, is, pretty expensive for her. Still waiting for someone to explain the new plan. Let me grab a call here from John in Burnsville. Hi, John. How are you thinking about this?
Terry, I'm offering two solutions for you.
All right.
This complicated problem. One is there are 10 or 11 other countries that do a better job with health care, that provide better outcomes for half the cost that we do, or approximately half the cost. And why not just adopt one of those programs and dust it up a little bit for the U.S. market? And for the people that say that socialized medicine, we already have socialized medicine from tax breaks for corporate plans to subsidies for individual care. Our medical program is already socialized. If you want to adopt a program that's not socialized, go to Germany's plan that was advocated in the Star Tribune a couple of weeks ago. There's full details on it. It's a private plan that everybody loves and is done for it. If you were to change the ratios, we would save about $1 trillion of GDP if we adopted the German plan, which,
let me do this, because we have other people that want to get in on this, not quarreling with the details of that. But Kimberly, I think on the politics of it, we are moving further away from, you know, what some of the other countries have been doing. And you wouldn't have been able to get anything that really looked like what Germany was doing or what Canada does or what the UK does through Congress when the Obamacare was being debated. Do you think I'm right that we're not going that way? We seem to be moving further away from that.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the words like single payer became, right, you know, political kryptonite here during the debate over healthcare, despite, you know, really strong advocacy for such an approach by folks like Senator Bernie Sanders, who really wanted to see a very much more left shifting approach to covering healthcare. And despite the fact that he had a lot of support, it wasn't nearly enough to make that politically palatable in Washington right now.
So, Kimberly, do you think this gets through Congress, or do you think the Rand Pauls and some of the Freedom Caucus managed to stop this, even though they're going to be told that the credibility of the legislative agenda is on the line?
Well, I think it depends on how much room that there is for negotiation. If you remember the first tweet about the Republican health care plan from the president said, you know, it's a great start, now room to negotiate. And you're right. You do have this faction of the Republicans, the conservatives, who are very unhappy with it. It calls it Obamacare light and doesn't think that it is in any way conservative enough fiscally or in terms of its policy. So you have to wait. If there is room to sort of, you know, have some carrots and sticks to bring these conservatives on board, then there's really nothing to stop this bill from passing when you have a Republican-controlled Congress and White House. So that's where the big question marks lie right now.
Kalila, we have two big hearings on deck for the beginning of next week. We have this House Intelligence Committee hearing, and then we have the Supreme Court nominee hearing. This House Intelligence Committee is supposed, we're going to hear from current directors of intelligence and former directors of intelligence. Is this the kind of hearing, I guess I want to ask this, is it the kind of hearing that can give us more clarity in the fog of all of these allegations and the political spin around it or not? I mean, what do you think, what will you draw from it, do you think?
I think that this set of hearings will be unlike any set of hearings we've had before. And we can go back as far as Oliver North to, you know, more recent challenges here. And here's why. The context is so different. So that no matter what comes out of that hearing, there will be a very divided American public who says, this is a partisan way to undermine our president. Or this is a partisan way to undermine our former president and former administration. So when we think about all of the allegations about Russian interference, about wiretapping, the fundamental question that gets overlooked is, what does this mean for American safety and security here at home and abroad? If that is not what comes out of these hearings, then it's really just become an exercise and theater.
Kimberly, what do you think?
I agree in large part. And it's not just about our national security and safety, but also, you know, integrity and trust in our election systems, right? I mean, that's what this sort of came out of, this idea that a foreign government can come in and use its influence in an illegal way to try to sway the election of United States of America. I mean, you know, we keep getting caught up in the details and the daily political push and pull of this. But that's what all of this arises from. It's an important issue. But I think nowadays, when it comes to any kind of hearing, when it comes to the public trying to get more information or a better understanding or a better handle on facts, it's much harder at these hearings for that to happen because it is so politicized. I mean, you're talking about the Supreme Court. That's another area too, where you know, real information about a nominee is really tough to come by from a hearing, and I think the politics of this has grown so loud that it will probably leave a lot of folks more confused than when it started.
You know, I don't want to miss what you've just said, Kimberly, because the magnitude of what we're talking about here, you're exactly right. It gets lost in the, well, you know, but I mean, we surveil other countries. You know, it gets lost in a lot of the tit for tat. That's the political stuff. The yes. magnitude of this is stunning, and I think we've all kind of taken in the details, and we're sort of moving on, accepting it, which is probably exactly what Putin and his cronies want.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it is really extraordinary. And I think, yes, it gets lost in the politicizing in the politics of the day, or even messaging from the White House from the beginning that, oh, this is just an attempt by Democrats, you know, a sour grapes thing because Hillary Clinton lost. I mean, from the very beginning, the messaging got very confusing, but it is. It's about a really fundamental principle that we don't allow foreign governments to come in and meddle with our government.
Kalila, you probably don't, you or Kimberly, have much doubt that Neil Gorsuch is going to be confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. But I guess my other question is about whether President Trump has an opportunity to not just reshape the U.S. Supreme Court, but also some of the federal judiciary as well. Is that something, Kalila, you've been thinking about?
I think so, especially if we consider over the last few days of calling for the resignation of the remaining U.S. attorneys, how that might be tied not just to past practice of requesting that, but the timing of this, of investigations happening at the state level, at the federal level as well. I think President Trump has made it clear that he is now in a position to shake things up and to shake things up in his favor. And will we have judicial appointees who will be beholden to the rule of law, to upholding the Constitution, or will they be shaped in some way by being beholden to the person who nominates them or the expectations of their office? And I think connecting to Kimberly's point previously, so many things that we're talking about, the essence of American society and a democratic society, are now at stake of things coming before the court.
Kalila, really good to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for being available to us. We appreciate
it. As always. Thank you.
Kimberly, how about you on shaping the federal judiciary as well as the Supreme Court?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right now, I think it's about 2/3 of the federal judiciary are Democratic appointees. So over the course of 4 or possibly 8 years, the White House has a chance to dramatically reshape the way the federal judiciary looks. And this is where these cases, the big cases that we like to talk about once they reach the Supreme Court, this is where they come from. You know, issues dealing with everything from abortion. There are many abortion laws that have been passed in states since the last time the Supreme Court really addressed it, from campaign finance reform, interpreting this new healthcare law once it's passed, which is surely to face challenges just as the last one did. That's going to be percolating up through the federal court. So it's going to have a tremendous impact on the laws of the country.
I thought I'd grab one last call here on healthcare, since I think the next time I talk to you, we'll probably still be talking about it. Kimberly, so let me take Mike in Grand Rapids. Hi, Mike. What was your experience with this? And is this something you voted on?
A pleasure
Mike,
to
go
meet
ahead.
You. Yes. My experience is that once you have opportunities and choices, I think it will be a lot better for most Americans, maybe not all. But my experience was, after many years of supporting a family, having good health care, I lost my job at the age 60 and decided to start my own business. So I had to start researching how to pay for this older guy's insurance. And my experience with MinSure was not a good one, as I was told basically to base my query on income, not on wealth. Uh-huh. So in other words, I have retirement savings. To me, that was what's wrong with the system. I could afford to do it, even though it was expensive. It would be double my COBRA, and I'd have a high deductible. Now, I think most people will have choices. My choice would be to carry a very high deductible, take care of my wellness visits, and keep my premiums low.
Okay. Mike, I have to stop you there, because, Kimberly, is he right that in the end there will be more choices if the Republicans pass what they're trying to?
I mean, I think it depends on what the definition of choice is. I mean, one choice obviously would be to not get health care at all. There will be tax incentives given on the basis of both age and income. Is sort of a slightly different formula that most of the folks that I talk to would mean fewer tax credits than we see under the current federal health care law. I think a lot of this we'll have to see.
Kimberly, bundle up there in Boston. Because
you too in New
it's
York.
Coming. That snow
yes,
is coming, and I know you're going to get hit by it too. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure. Good to have you here.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Tomorrow, from New York in the Marketplace Studios, I'm going to be talking about the science of taste and flavor and odor. Will be a good conversation. Join us tomorrow.